Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today, I have a special guest, Liz Hall. Liz is editor and co-owner of Coaching at Work. She's a senior leadership coach, and her work is informed by mindfulness, compassion, and somatics. Liz is also an author of mindfulness books on coaching, and she's co-founder of Coaching Through COVID and Beyond. Liz, you're welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you?
Oh, I'm really happy to be here. Very, very delighted you've invited me on this podcast, Simon. I'm looking forward to it. Let's see.
Good. And just to say where you're speaking from today.
I'm in southern Spain. So it is very hot, as you might imagine. So yeah, joining you from southern Spain today.
Good. So Liz, I mean, I've known you for quite a while. You've been editor of Coaching at Work for how many years around?
Yeah, so I was the launch editor. So 2005 is when the magazine launched. Yeah, and we bought it out in 2009, a bunch of us.
CIPD. Well, it's a great read, and it's really important in coaching. So today, I'd really like to explore some of the themes around coaching, which you've seen over the years through that work, because you kind of interview and you engage so many kind of coaches across the world. What's your kind of picture, big picture of coaching at the moment? What's going on, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're still seeing coaching being very well thought of, and this is growing globally. So I don't think we've seen any tail off with that. Obviously, with economic struggles, what we do see, I think, is individual coaches sometimes struggling to make ends meet. But I think for some time, it's been a case of coaches having portfolio. So they won't just do coaching clients. A lot of people will also have training, they'll be offering all sorts of other bits, leadership development, what have you. So I think we're seeing more of that in the current climate. So that's, I think, one trend. We're not seeing coaching seem to grow, but it's not that easy. And there's still a lot of coaches coming into the market.
I mean, it's a really full market. I mean, there's that many coaching and development courses and trainings, including my own, in the market.
Exactly. Lots to choose from, which is good. So I think that idea of coaches being better able to select what suits them, you know, how they show up, who are they, and what courses might help them bring that to the fore. I think that's very much the case. But yeah.
And do you see any major trends in coaching? I mean, there's I think mindfulness is your speciality is growing. I've kind of noted that. What other trends have you seen happening in coaching?
So I think we're seeing internal coaching just growing, and off the back of that, as organisations get more sophisticated, we're seeing more internal coaching supervision, more internal evaluation, all the rest of it. So I think as organisations are getting much more nuanced in terms of what they're doing with internal coaching, which does offer opportunities for individual practitioners to come in and support them in doing that. So I think we thought there might be a tail off in work, but it hasn't actually come to be, because there's often a blend of external plus internal. But that continues to be the case. So I think organisations in the past were very much waiting to take the lead from accreditation bodies and all the rest of it, whereas now they're key players. And some really wonderful work being done. So for example, Nat West, Nick, whose surname is escaping me right this moment, but Nick from Nat West. So wonderful, wonderful work being done in organisations these days.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm wondering, when coaching first started, I kind of was really interested in watching, you know, being a therapist, I was watching coaching grow. And I initially thought it was going to be a fad. I thought it was going to be like it would peak and then it would kind of drop off and it would have a kind of a low level impact, like a lot of other kind of leadership development fads, but it's not. It's like it grew and it grew and it grew, and it kind of it's either stabilized or slowly continued to grow. And what sense can we make of that? Why is coaching so necessary?
And it's interesting what you're saying, because I too a bit wondered if it was a fad, because running a magazine, having to curate content, I thought I'm going to run out of things to write about and to source from other people, but there's always something new around the corner. So I think why is coaching, I think partly because it does keep reinventing itself in the same way as therapy. So there'll be new things coming through, or coaching profession will suddenly realize that there's something in therapy that could be really useful. So it could be, for example, in dialectical behavioral therapy, you know, now being sort of adapted for the coaching field, etc., etc. So there's lots of different sources of new material or repurposed material that is of interest. But I think, the world is in a mess, as we know, and people are crying out for some way to be supported to make sense of that. Therapy is wonderful. I have therapy, but it's not for everyone for various reasons. You know, they may not just not see themselves as being, you know, that being right for them. And coaching can set, I'm very, very up for sort of this, you know, Ernesto Spinelli talked about that fuzzy line between coaching and therapy, you know, and so I'm all about that. I think that, you know, if we say that we can't coach someone who's got issues and all the rest of it, then that is absolutely ludicrous, you know, because everyone's kind of struggling, it seems. So I think that's part of it. Coaching is fulfilling a role, like a priest almost, or a therapist, you know, it just needs support in navigating these times. So I think that's part of it. And I think also in businesses, you know, leaders, for example, I mean, what they're being asked to do is crazy, you know, and they're still expected to be experts. So in terms of adult development, they're the achievers, they're the experts, yet what's really required of them is to be in the post-conventional space if they're really going to make a difference. Yeah. And be able to sit with not knowing all of the things we talk about and write about without thinking about it. But how on earth do you get a leader to be able to operate in the space that's required these days? So I think that's part of it as well. Yes, we sort of have the niche in terms of leadership coaching. I think it's you know, so important that leaders have coaches.
I think that's important. There's a couple of things came to my mind. I mean, in my coaching and mentoring critical textbook, I try and trace a history of coaching, and I go right back to sort of pre-modern times, you know, ancient times, and thinking about shamans and healers, and really recognizing that coaching is not kind of a new invention. It's kind of part of a trajectory, and it grew out of these. Then there was spiritual direction, there was kind of a mentoring, and then there's therapy and psychoanalysis, and then different forms of therapy. And coaching kind of is drawn on all these kind of one-to-one helping relationships. And it was interesting you just mentioned, like, you know, the new priests I do think that you also said something which struck with me, that therapy is not for everybody. And a lot of people in the workplace who have very driven, very successful, like, therapy was really known for people who had problems. You know, you went to therapy to kind of if you had relationship problems, or if you had kind of concerns, patterns in your life you weren't happy with. And a lot of people in the workplace, particularly successful leaders, managers, men and women, were kind of defended against that, because they had to kind of put on this kind of strong face, this I'm successful face. And I think coaches managed to touch those people who wouldn't go to therapy, because it was like acknowledging that they were kind of challenged, but do go to coaching. And I think it's been really important there.
Absolutely, totally agree. And I think when I say therapy is not for everyone, I think therapy can help so many people. It's just that they don't necessarily want to, you know, they don't see themselves as that being for them. So absolutely, I think it's had a huge impact with all sorts of people who would never have thought they needed the support.
And then you mentioned work, and the workplace has changed. I mean, managers used to get trained to kind of do the finances, the control, to do stuff, and now so much relationship work, emotional work. I mean, to be a manager, to be a leader these days, you receive projections, there's emotions in the workplace.
I know, right? Who knew? Emotions. But thought we had to leave them at the door, you know.
Which we did in the 1950s, like,
we did, we did. But yeah, absolutely. There's a lot for them to contend with, definitely. Yeah.
And with the new generation coming in, even more so.
Yeah, definitely. And different sort of generational preferences, and, you know, I mean, Gen X and Gen Y, Gen Z, you know, just different things they're looking for in the work. place, meaning, purpose, you know, all the rest of it. They want development, they want career development. And so, I mean, I think managers, especially old school managers, are just, you know, like really lost, I think, sometimes, and they do need that sort of help with developing a coaching style so they can really get the best out of these younger workers, and vice versa, that younger employees can contribute more.
So absolutely,
that going on as well.
Yeah, so it's alive and it's well. And what about your work, Liz? Tell me about your work, your coaching work. You talk about mindfulness and somatics. Tell us a bit about your personal practice.
Yeah, so I've written about this in my books, but I discovered mindfulness when I was a sort of working single mum, writing about work-life balance and all that kind of stuff. So I was writing for HR and business publications, as well as nationals, but sort of there I was really struggling personally, tearing my hair out, writing about work-life balance, which is quite ironic. But a friend of mine talked to me about mindfulness, and I really loved the idea at that time, because I didn't have any time, so I had a young baby, but I didn't have to go off on a retreat or anything like that. I could start to sort of be mindful in what I was doing. So I kind of fell in love with it then and started researching different ways of learning about mindfulness, including through Buddhism. But I, for a while, I was, as were many other people, a closet meditator, because I there I was sort of developing, starting to run this coaching magazine and starting to work as a coach. And then I had my secret mindfulness practice, because you just didn't sort of mention this in business circles. Mm-hmm. It was very fluffy and spiritual with a, I don't know which, whether it be a capital or lowercase, but, you know, it was deemed to be something just for the spiritual setting, if we can separate secular and spiritual, which I don't think we can. But it was a strange time, and you'd go to a conference and come across someone else who meditated or whatever. Someone else, oh, right, let's just talk about that, shall we? You know, kind of secret sort of members of these clubs. And then it started to become more mainstream. But I think in those early days, my fascination, because I started to think, well, if it's benefiting me, I'm sure it'll benefit my clients. I started to kind of weave it into some of my coaching, but there wasn't that much written about it, which was what prompted me to write my first book, which is Mindful Coaching. So sort of one of many pioneers. There are many people contributing in this space. I certainly want to claim I was the only one, but it was early days. So it was that time trying to bring the benefits that I was experiencing. Mental hygiene, as you know, Michael Chaskowson talks about. Just you know, how it would help me be more resourceful, more present, more happier, really, etc.
And you talk about somatics. Do you do body work in your coaching?
I do. I mean, so that there's sort of, it all links really, but mindfulness, compassion and the embodied work, for me, it all sort of interlinks, because I think in the West, we tend to imagine we can just live in our head, which of course is, you know, the skull-based brain, which of course isn't possible. And we have that sort of sense of cutting off from the neck downwards. So a lot of my clients will be, and myself, anyone really, will be very much kind of in the conceptual space and just ignoring all the wisdom in their body. So I think it's something about opening up to the wisdom that our body has to share with us, but also using the body as a crucible for transformation, because I think we can have all this awareness in our mind, but it's unless we start having that be embodied, we don't move on. And that was something that I experienced, you know, when I was coached back in the day, and I knew something, but then I suddenly knew it in my body, you know, and then that was when the shifts would take place. So yeah, I do use it in coaching. I mean, again, gently, because not everyone's, you know, for all sorts of reasons, it can be quite scary for people, particularly if they've got attachment injuries, some kind of trauma. So I think it's gently, but just getting people to notice what's going on in their body, just even dropping in that question, you know, from that to a bit more full-blown kind of, you know, centering practices, really kind of getting in touch with something from their past and what feelings are there, and just helping them work through that. Also, I use it in all sorts of ways, really, just embodying, so it's a big part of my work.
Yeah, the body is hugely important. I'm working more and more in that space, and in my coaching courses I now talk about composting and weaving rather than reflecting, because reflecting is like a cognitive thing you do. You go away and you think, you know, and of course thinking is very important, but also the body holds so much. It holds the unconscious, it holds the emotions, it holds the tensions, you know. So when we do composting, we get people to kind of wander around, go into the outside if they can, get some air, move their bodies. And it shifts something. It's really, really important. And just kind of that awareness is kind of hugely important.
Totally. So I think we're really missing a trick if we don't don't bring that in, to be honest. It's sort of unfair to the client to not open up to that.
It is. I'm a critical theorist, and a lot of the critical kind of work on coaching and mindfulness, and they pose a question: are we just kind of patching people up and putting them back into kind of the workplace to be more productive? Is it just kind of using spirituality instrumentally? Is it kind of stealing from Buddhism just to kind of make Microsoft more wealthy? What do you say to people who kind of ask those questions?
Well, I love that those questions are being asked, to be honest. That whole idea of mindfulness, I think it's been dubbed, hasn't it, by one author. I think it is a real danger that mindfulness is, and I think maybe not quite so much now, because it's almost, organisations are realising it can't be a blaster for toxic culture. But yeah, these kind of little tasters, and we've done our bit. I had one organisation where they'd been to suicides, and they reached out to me to see if I could go in and run a bit of a little session on, or some stuff on mindfulness, you know, sort of that. I got the intention, but it was like, my goodness, that's not going to fix it all, really. So I think we have to be really careful, as with coaching, really, what we promise and what the expectations are, and all the rest of it. And like you, I would always try and take a systemic stance anyway with any work that I do. So I think that's the thing. It's just not having too high expectations.
Yes,
I think there's also something around individual mindfulness can only go so far. So my own experience, the research in you know, public domain around mindfulness-based stress reduction programs, etc., shows that if we have an individual mindfulness practice, that will ripple out. You know, we'll hear that, you know, parents, partners and co-workers will say, oh, you're not as grumpy as you used to be, or, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, you listen more, or you're not flying off the handle. So yeah, of course that's going to ripple out, and perhaps it goes only so far, particularly if it's in a toxic culture that we're talking about. So we're seeing a lot more work around what it means to have collective mindfulness. So some work done, I was part of a team with Institute of Employment Studies with Cranfield University and the Armed Forces, where they were looking at how to have team mindfulness, and other people have done stuff. There's been quite a lot of work on relational mindfulness. I'm going to be co-authoring a book with Dr. Emma Donaldson Fielder on relational mindfulness. So it's something about, okay, how can we really ramp this up? How can we have other sort of formal practices that are about bringing mindfulness into interpersonal sphere? And I think that's really exciting. So Yeah, it can only go so far. I totally get that, particularly in
the
toxic culture.
I'm finding the HROD space are becoming more educated. They used to kind of be asking questions like, you know, are you a member of this profession? And now they're kind of asking more questions about how does this impact beyond the individual? How can we, and I'm doing some really interesting work where we put a number of coaches into an organization, and then we, without breaking confidentiality, we harvest the themes which come back.
Brilliant.
And we feed those themes back into the system. So you've got this individual personal support and development going on, and you've got the systemic piece. You know, you're saying, like, you know, there's some key themes. You know, 10 of the people are talking about kind of a bullying culture here. You know, we need to notice this. There's some, needs to be some structural changes, you know. And that to me is like a really powerful coaching work. And then you do some team coaching as well, and you share stuff. So mixing the individual, the team, and the system, I think is really kind of the future direction of coaching. Well, I hope so.
Yeah, absolutely agree. And I think when I talked earlier about the more sophisticated organisations, they were doing that. They were harvesting the common themes, but loads of organisations weren't doing that.
No.
Because I think the fact that it's starting to become a bit more commonplace, that makes sense, right? You know, it totally does. And maybe even beyond. So that's got a system in terms of organisation, but there's beyond as well, isn't there? You know, climate, you know, agenda, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's huge. And the other thing I'm working with OD and HR people on is, like, the word coaching means an awful lot of things, as you and I both know. And it, you know, people can show up as coaches with a huge variety of experience and ideas. Even the idea about what coaching is, I'm talking about that in a conference, an Animus conference in a week's time. And it's questioning the idea. They're talking about kind of a transformational coaching, and they've invited me in to be a critical thinker because I critique the idea of transformational coaching. And it's like, you know, asking the questions, what idea do we have in our minds when we think about coaching? Because often the HR person has a different idea to the coach, who has a different idea to the client.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's so important, isn't it, to bottom out what we mean. I think we're better at doing that in an individual coaching session. But maybe not so good at doing it in that wider space. And it's so important. So important.
It is. And if you think about collecting the information off different coaches, you know, if you've got one coach who's a positive psychology coach, if you've got another who's a CBT coach, if you've got another who's from a different frame, you know, they're going to have quite different conversations, and they're going to go in different directions. So really kind of trying to understand how coaches kind of are working systemically, I think is really key to the future of coaching.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we know that the people who are procuring coaching, they should be asking how the coach actually does their work and how they individually, you know, what informs them and all the rest of it. But I think that should definitely be one of the questions too, shouldn't it? Sort of what are you doing systemically? How do you bring this to life systemically?
So, yeah.
Yeah.
And asking the coach, you know, are they getting supervision? Because that's another big
supervision?
One.
Yeah, absolutely. And even are they, well, they wouldn't want to say this, but are they weaving? Are they composting? Are they putting aside time for reflection? You know,
that's
aside
right.
From supervision. Yeah, no, it's an interesting times we live in.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that's like to know whether a coach is going to be working well, asking those questions is more important than if they kind of tick the box to get a professional accreditation, because that can mean a lot of hours put in. But like, to really know what development, personal development they're doing, what reflection they're doing, what supervision they're doing, what kind of ongoing training they're doing, that tells you a lot.
Yeah.
About the coach.
Exactly.
Can you tell us something about your you started a not-for-profit, coaching through COVID and beyond. Can you tell me about what that's about and kind of why you did that?
Yeah, so myself, Mark McMordy, Lindsay Wittenberg, and Carol Oswell. It was the pandemic hit basically, and Mark McMordy put out a post on LinkedIn saying, "What can we do as coaches?" And the four of us got together, and then others joined as well, and set up this not-for-profit just to see what we could do to help, really. And so what we did was we ended up delivering more than, at last count, it was more than 500 sort of coaching assignments. So, you know, coaching engagements. It's much more than that now. I think it went up to 600 and so. But yeah, basically offering coaching to anybody at any level. So porters, nurses, you know, weren't being hierarchical about it. We were really careful to recruit coaches who, I mean, I absolutely get what you're saying. To kind of make sure there was a checklist in terms of they were definitely getting supervision, they were a member of an accrediting body, etc. We had some, what we wanted was as clutterbuck, the mature eclectic coaches who could work with trauma, really, because we didn't know what was going to show up. We didn't know what people had been going through. They weren't all on the front line, but some were. So you know, this kind of idea that they had to be psychologically informed, etc., know when they needed to go off and get support. We ran a whole bunch of CPD for the coaches, have a really strong community with like trauma-based coaching or, you know, diversity and inclusion, etc. So what we hadn't really thought about was how much we would get out of it. The joy and, you know, learning was immense. So it was a wonderful experience, really, for so many of us. But the main thing was that in terms of what the impact was, we've done some evaluation recently and, yeah, really blown away with, I mean, the NHS is huge. We could have touched a lot of people, but it was wonderful to have at least done that. Yeah.
Have you written anything up, or are you going to write anything up? I'd be very interested to read. I'm sure my listeners would.
I will send something. We did write up an article in Coaching at Work about a year ago, which looked at where we got to at that point. And we're going to be writing up the results of the evaluation. And one of the things that's coming through really strongly, I think, is our ethos was really key. We really, you know, prioritised mindfulness and compassion in the core team, in the wider community. We offered compassion training. When we had our core team meetings, we did check-ins. You know, for psychological safety, we'd do mindfulness and all the rest of it. So there was something about how we operated together that was really lovely, which I think did spill out. So we talked about toxic cultures. I like to think ours wasn't a toxic culture, that people could speak up and, you know, because we had a series of volunteers coming and going, so it was really important to keep that going. But really happy to send a link to that article that appeared in Coaching at Work. It's normally for subscribers, the magazine, but that one we have made publicly available, and to keep you posted for anything else that we write.
Good, and we'll put that on the website for the listeners to look at.
I mean,
I've just started a new project with Save the Children International. They've invited me to do some work with them, beginning in Ukraine, and working with leaders in crisis situations, and trauma is a big part of that. And like you say, you can't just kind of expect all coaches to jump into that space. So really thinking about kind of what the work the coach is going to do, because I think it's one of the problems with coaching. And it started when I trained as a psychotherapist many years ago. There was a lot of counselors, and they do sort of a Carl Rogers person-centered counseling and learn how to kind of be good listeners. But they think that they could address any client. And I'm like, well, you really don't understand mental illness. You really don't understand kind of trauma issues. There's kind of big gaps in that. And to understand our lack and our gaps as coaches, I think is a huge kind of thing as well.
I totally agree. I think it's really easy for us not to be equipped to operate in that space because of our own attachment injuries, for example, or whatever, and what we're being presented with. And as I said earlier, I think danger is that we might think, I just won't operate in that space. But actually, any leader, anyone we coach could present with all sorts of stuff. And so I think it's knowing when to refer on, being better equipped to actually, because I think we can do a lot more in coaching than we might think.
Yes, yeah.
That's the thing. You know, yeah. And if they, like we said earlier, they might not going to go to therapy. You know, how lovely if we could do our little bit and support this fellow human traveller.
Yeah,
who's courageous enough to come to coaching.
And was a lot of the work you did online? I mean, what's your view of coaching online? It's is it just become mainstream for you now?
It has pretty much. I mean, I think we've all had to have a steep learning curve there. You know, all my kind of in person gigs that I did with workshops and one day workshops, half day workshops, I now do online. I mean, I'm open. I did something in Iceland that was in person, which was lovely, going to Iceland. But I'm trying not to do it too much anyway because of the climate, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I'm trying not to accept invitations where they'll only do it in person. But I think it works really well. I mean, the somatic work I do is all online now, you know. Mm-hmm. So we've got the camera on, I'll stand up, you know, I'll do weird and wonderful things and see them doing weird and wonderful things, and we'll do it all online. But it's different, isn't it? It's different. I think we've become better at knowing how to keep the community engaged, you know, the group engaged, taking more breaks, maybe that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's just different, doable.
It's doable, and it's definitely better for the environment, yeah.
Exactly. I mean,
It's important that we don't find ourselves jumping on planes all the time. I mean, some of it's still necessary, but managing it. What thoughts do you have about the future going ahead, coaching? Any kind of key thoughts or desires? I mean, I ask a question in my coaching, going, what is your desire? So what is your desire for coaching, Liz, in the future, for yourself and for the field?
Yeah, I mean, without wanting to cast us as saviours on, you know, white horses or whatever, you know, come charging in to save the world, I think there has been asked me earlier about trends. I think one of the trends is that coaches are much more willing and courageous in terms of stepping into the systemic space. So I think things like the climate crisis, things like diversity, inclusion, belonging, actually, that shift where before we would, no, I can't possibly talk about that because it's not this individual client's agenda. So just gentle invitational ways of bringing in systemic issues into coaching, we're seeing more of. Certainly something in terms of content and coaching at work that, you know, we're writing a lot more about with ways to do that. I'm doing lots more of it. So I think that would be one part of my vision, is that we get better at working with trauma and stuff like that, mental struggles. Yeah. Because I think that's where we're at, really. That's the pandemic, the other pandemic, isn't it? So I think any coach who says, I can't do any of that, I think is quite deluded, really. So I think that's one part of it. And then being much better able to play our part. And it's just one small part, of course it is, but play our part as a profession. So the profession itself, the bodies, the individual coaches, coach training bodies, play our part in addressing the systemic issues of our times. So I think that's one big part of it, really. What else? I'm a bit of a sort of, I wouldn't say, I'm not very tech savvy, but I get excited vicariously. of all the wonderful things that are becoming possible with in the digital space to get coaching to reach more people the world and be less less only available for the sort of executives and so on. So I think that's exciting. So my vision would be probably not me, but for others to really run with that and make a huge difference, because it is exciting. I just it doesn't quite float my boat. Maybe it will one day.
Well, it's a future. I mean, it's whether we like it or not, it's so interesting how there was such a resistance for therapists and coaches and counselors to kind of work online. And then the COVID came and I have psychoanalysts who wouldn't even dream, it was kind of really breaking all the taboos, you have to come and lie on the couch, and they were like, wow, this works.
Exactly. And how we can be creative around that, of the lovely whizzy tools and bits and bobs and cards that we used or whatever, and there's loads of ways of doing that online, aren't there? So just keeping
well, when the metaverse comes, I mean, that's I was talking to someone on a podcast about Web3, and like you, I'm not a real techie, but it kind of interests me and just like the potential there for coaching in the metaverse and sort of
avatars.
The avatar, the whole world is kind of for the next generation of coaches. This is exciting. I think there's huge possibilities. Lovely to talk to you, Liz. We end our podcast with two questions, and I ask my guests what it means to live a good life, what advice they can give to my audience, and what it takes to create a good society. So any hints or tips around what it means to live a good life for yourself and how to create a good society?
So I think for me, living a good life includes taking time away from the screen and worky triggers, so emails, whatever. And for me, it's often mindfulness. That'd be a formal mindfulness practice that I do most days, if not daily, and taking time out in nature. So I can forget sometimes how important it is. This weekend, went to the local beautiful rocky beach. We watched the sunset with a bunch of friends, and then we watched the moon rise. It was a red moon because it's reflecting the sun. Absolutely beautiful. Went in the water, and it's still with me. On a Monday morning, but at the time, both my husband and I were a bit tired, we just say, but the value of it, I think it's so important, particularly in these times. So for me, it's finding ways to disconnect from technology. It's finding ways to plug into nature. It's finding ways to do some mental hygiene. So it might not be formal practice, but just, whatever. Listening to music, whatever it is for other people, I guess. For me, it's a form of mindfulness practice. And generally, what it means to contribute to a good society, did you say?
Yes, yeah. How do we make things better, in short?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all have to find our own way of doing that. So, for example, I think we all have to step up personally. I think we do have to step up to these systemic issues, but we have to find our own way. So, for example, I was a part of Extinction Rebellion for a while, but I realized at my age, stomping around, my back was aching, everyone was shouting in the protest. So for me, taking a back seat and coaching climate activists and writing about stuff, so that's my contribution there. So I feel we do have to step up, because actually, if not us, then who? If not now, then when? But it's finding the way that we can do that, what our strengths are, and not feeling like we have to do everything.
Sure
Yeah.
Great wisdom. Liz Hall, thank you very much for your wisdom. You've been very kind. Take care. Go well.
Very much enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Coming up, we have our next advanced coach program. We now have 400 coaches trained internationally. If you're a coach, a leader, or a consultant wishing to develop your coaching skills, come to this advanced program. It's online for 12 weeks, and I'll be leading that program.